I'm Richard, and welcome to EsoTorque's podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of September 23rd, 2013. Join us this week as we talk with Los Angeles poet Suzanne Lummis about poetry in the Southland, from her grandfather Charles Fletcher Lummis's day to Charles Bukowski and into the present. We'll also visit with Patricia Adler Ingram, executive director of the Southern California Historical Society, about their longtime headquarters, El Alisal, the home Charles Fletcher Lummis built for his family more than a century ago. So stay tuned. Los Angeles.
El Pueblo, Lotus Land, the City of Angels.
The Day of the Locust, the slide area, where all the fruits and nuts ended up when they turned the country on its ear.
But you and I were born here. Don't mind a few oddballs in the mix.
They add flavor. Growing up in Cheviot Hills, my compass pointed straight to 5th and Main.
As a kid in Hollywood, I was forbidden to take the bus to the Central Library, but I did it anyway.
Because you've got to start at the center to understand this confounding and fantastic city.
Which makes nonsense of history and breaks all the rules.
Rainer Banham said that.
He taught us well.
In the 1980s at UC Santa Cruz, now on our tours and in our time travel blogs, we're continuing the conversation.
Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles and Charles Bukowski's The Birth of Noir. Route 66, the lowdown on downtown. The real Black Dahlia.
Positive public space, endangered landmarks, forgotten lore,
memory maps, mysteries, murder,
the allocation of resources,
the hidden forces that shape public policy,
Skid Row,
Bunker Hill,
preservation,
restoration,
redevelopment.
It's a four-letter word.
Los Angeles. You can't eat the sunshine, but you can drive around and take a long, hard look.
And listen to the stories.
And pass them on. Why are we doing this again?
Because we love the place with a passion that goes beyond sense or reason.
So did Rainer Banham.
So he did. Now let's begin.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland Park, Grand Central Park. It is divine. Sunshine, but it's a gold mine of fabulous oddities like Brooke Shears, Dairy, Angela's Abbey, Bob's Big Boy, in Downey Forest Lawn Cemetery. You can't eat the sunshine, but make a beeline for la la la. You can't eat the sunshine.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast, You Can't Eat the Sunshine, for the week of September 23rd, 2013. This week, our two guests will be poet Suzanne Lummis, who is also the granddaughter of Charles Fletcher Lummis. Our other guest will be Pat Adler Ingram. Pat is executive director of the Southern California Historical Society. They have their headquarters at Charles Fletcher Lummis's house, El Alisal, in northeast Los Angeles, probably what is technically not Highland Park, but what I call Highland Park, right at Avenue 43. I think Avenue 43 is just the border of Montecito Heights Highland Park, northeast Los Angeles on the Arroyo. So we have a lot to look forward to. And Kim, I want you to remind people about the Pishkah.
That would be the digital tip jar, which is associated with this podcast. And if you like it, which we certainly hope that you do, we'd appreciate it if you'd consider throwing a little something into said digital tip jar. It helps us keep up on the gasoline charges while roaming around Southern California looking for lovely people to talk to for you to listen to. It's not obligatory, but we certainly appreciate the support we've been getting from listeners, as well as all of the great feedback. So thank you.
Thank you, Kim. I appreciate that. Your grandmother is always happy when you give a pitch for the Pishkah.
When I put the little hat out?
Yeah.
It's a very little hat.
So, Kim, well, you know, Kim, they taught me in Hebrew school you have to meditate on the size of the hat you hold out. It's the size of the hat. How big do you need your hat to be? How much do you need?
Is it a hat? I didn't realize it was.
Whatever
a hat.
It is you put out.
The bowl.
God to fill. Yeah. It's not that you put one out that you need filling. It's what is the size.
I understand, I think.
That's, yes.
That was before they threw you out of Hebrew school.
That was the
that was
three
like day
days.
One, yes.
I functioned in Hebrew school.
I always like these stories, yes.
Let's move on to closely watched trains. We have several of them. You sent me a very nice link. I don't know if it's nice, but you sent me a link, and I liked the copy in it, so I'm just gonna jump into this.
I liked that link, too, because I think it's hard to talk about what's going on with the Chinese theater.
Right, which is why we're just going to read from the article, just
right,
a couple sentences.
And link to the entire piece, because this is someone who has a really terrific context on the history of the Chinese. So please, go ahead.
Right. Friday was a banner day for Ellie, Samana, and Doug Kirshner, who bought the theater, Grauman's Chinese, who bought the theater for Chinese television manufacturer TCL, which bought the naming rights, and for Warner Brothers, which bought distribution rights for MGM's film library. It will also mark a milestone in the ongoing slow-motion death of celluloid. For the first time in its 86-year history, the TCL Chinese theater does not have a film projector in its projection booth.
That's right, it's gone IMAX. It's the now sound. It's what's happening. It's what all the kids are listening to.
And it's really, Kim, it's all about the here and now and what the kids want. It is.
And the kids apparently want to see...
They want IMAX.
The Wizard of Oz in 3D.
And dinosaurs.
Can we argue with this? I mean, come on. Every time we walk in front of the Chinese, which I'm not going to call the TCL, I'm not going to call it the Mans either. Every time we walk in front of the Chinese, I say the same thing. This is just like that scene in Day of the Locust. It's unbelievable. I'm waiting for them to start beating someone to death and set the place on fire. So, listen, if it's what the kids
which they routinely do.
Yeah, a lot of people have been dying on the boulevard. It's gotten very violent. So, you know, if that's what the people who are coming to that intersection are going to pay to see, IMAX, I guess that's okay.
Kim,
it's all about the ballyhoo.
No, it's what the kids want. It's what's now. It's what's happening. Which brings us to our next closely watched train. Wonderful article in last week's LA Times about this charming Swiss national, Ilse, who is a gung-ho, decades-long, up-to-her-elbows in the manure and the hay preservationist in San Juan Capistrano. And it is precisely what kids want, the here and now, and dinosaurs, that I will focus on this wonderful, lengthy profile of a really wonderful person. I'm looking forward to catching up with her for a cup of coffee down there one time soon, maybe at the Keeler murals. So in this great article, which covers many wonderful fronts and projects and gripes she has with the world, one of them is dinosaurs. In downtown, there is a petting zoo, and the owner bought a dinosaur, a fairly large dinosaur.
No, you can buy dinosaurs.
Okay, it was a model. Okay, Kim, come on.
It's a sculpture.
It's a sculpture of a dinosaur. And she put it in the petting zoo, and Ilse just looked at it and just rolled her eyes and said, this is not what the city needs, and she helped get it moved to Arizona. So she helped get it out of her community. And the article goes into length about the owner of the petting zoo imploring Ilse, this is what kids want. This is now. No one cares about yesterday.
And, you know, if you live in a 18th century town, you maybe do have to care about yesterday. I'm sure everyone who doesn't like Ilse's way of doing things is just waiting for her to pass over to the other side. She is pretty elderly, but I think that preservation does keep you young and it keeps you working, so she may be around a little longer than anyone anticipates. And she's right. If you're going to walk through San Juan Capistrano and get this early Californiano experience, you really don't want to see a sculpture of a dinosaur. You don't even want to see a real dinosaur because they didn't live around here.
Okay, Kim, good job.
Historical accuracy is important, Richard.
Okay, Kim. So just a note, you sent me an interesting link. The city of Burbank is concerned about what the world has come to know as McMansionization.
Well, the problem is they don't call it McMansionization, and I think this is important. The houses, when you're mocking them, you call them a McMansion, right, which is a reference, of course, to fast food and these fast food restaurants that go up in no time at all. But when they talk about the problem of houses being built almost to the property line and dwarfing the the existing housing stock. They don't say McMansionization, they say mansionization. And I think people are perhaps less inclined to be opposed to mansionization, because doesn't everyone want a mansion? They're not mansions, though. They're crap boxes.
Okay, so it's all actually completely irrelevant, whatever you call it, because all Burbank, the city of Burbank, is concerned about what they feel is a trend in remodeling structures that are out of character with the existing neighborhood. And the solution to that is, Kim, can you say it in unison with me?
H-P-O-Z.
Right. Which Glendale has. And our friend Jay helped put together.
Historic Preservation Overlay Zone. These are directives because, frankly, most people have deplorable taste. They may not know it. And the worst people of all are the ones who just have a little money and hire someone to tell them what they want.
Ask Ilsa.
She knows. Listen, if you want a bigger house, move to the burbs. If you want to live in a cute little neighborhood, just respect your neighbors. You don't have to build to the property line.
Kim, some good news from the state circuit, state superior court. We got a note. The judge said UCLA can't sell the property,
yeah,
the gardens,
the Hannah Carter Japanese gardens. I don't know if this is the end of the line. This
no,
is an
not.
Appeal.
It's
an
not.
Ongoing situation.
It was an appeal, and the judge rejected the appeal. They are pushing it up to a higher court, and so.
They can't sell it, and they also must maintain it, which is really questionable. I mean, can anyone even go in there anymore? It was falling apart when we visited it before they announced the plan to sell.
We were there in 2005, 2006, and I actually called the Torrance Koi Society and said, you have to get these koi out of here. They're very sick. They have no idea what they're doing, and they just don't care.
Yeah, and so when they decided they were going to actually put the Carter House, which they're legally allowed to sell, and the garden, which they're legally not allowed to sell, both were given as a gift to the university with the understanding, the accepted understanding that the university would maintain the garden, which is world-class for future generations. The attempt to sell the garden was immediately followed by moving one of the large pagodas, which are, you know, an integral part of the garden design, to the Fowler Museum. So what the current condition of the historical elements of the garden, the plants, I assume the koi are gone. Gosh.
I hope the koi are gone
because no, oh boy. It's really sad. And I think it makes people think twice about giving to a university like UCLA because they're ingrates.
Biofiltration. They had the worst biofiltration system I've ever seen. In 1961, it might have been cutting edge.
State of the art. Oh boy.
So we're going to move on. So interesting. Christ's Cathedral, the Reverend Dr. Robert Schuller's complex in Garden Grove, consisting of several architecturally significant structures, not the least of which is the 68 Neutra Church, which
it's as late as that.
Is it? I think it's. Oh no, it's 62. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's 62.
It's quite good. It's beautiful.
It's not the least of which is the Neutra structure, the Philip Johnson Crystal Cathedral. Richard Meyer has a visitor center there. 2010.
Undistinguished.
Undistinguished.
And they blew a lot of money on it.
Okay, but that's what they did, and now they're bankrupt, and now the Catholic Church has bought the complex, and they're removing the stepping stones. Not per se because on moral grounds of they can't have these stepping stones because now it's under the see of the Catholic Diocese of the County of Orange, of Orange County. I guess it's Orange County, not the County of Orange. It's not for some moral reason. It's contractors need to get in and bring in a lot of heavy equipment, and they're going to destroy the stepping stones if they do. So out of respect to that, they're removing them. They have no plans to put them back, and they've contacted all the donors and let them know that they can come pick up their stones, or if they want to pick up the cost of freight, they'll ship to them.
Right, and it reminds me of what happened over at KCET when that old studio was sold to the Church of Scientology and people who had paid to put bricks in the walkways with family members and loved ones' names on it were pretty upset, too. It's a strange way of acquiring donations, I think, because everyone makes the assumption that it's forever, and it's not. It's a decorative sort of element. I think if you want to really contribute to something, plant a tree.
I think a lot of the people interviewed for the article who were donors, they were recent donors, and they knew that there was a lot of financial distress. So I think they acquired a lot of them in the latter days of the church, and everyone was it was already on the table that things were financially very shaky.
Yeah, I wish that they had just written checks to that poor woman who provided all of the animals for the last couple of Easter spectaculars. You know, she didn't get paid. She brought the llamas and everything. The trombonist didn't get paid. I don't know what happened to that place.
Well, Kim, we're going to move on. So we're going to end on a happy note.
From glass to glass.
Right. So our good friend Dave Judson is wrapping up another commission. This commission, now this is where it gets, the commission is to restore the transom windows on the Masonic Hall in Figueroa. We let you, like 2 months ago, this was an issue that they've been ripped out. It's an historic cultural monument. That's a designated element of the historic
cultural register.
Great. It's the municipal landmarking is what got Edgar Garcia to write them a letter. Okay, the Secretary of the Interior didn't write a letter.
No, and it was politically embarrassing because Gil Cedillo, new councilman for the district, is actually putting his office in this building.
So they ripped them out. They got a letter. Dave Judson has a new commission. Good. Restore these individual panes that make up these, 25-30 pane transom window blocks.
No, they're not transoms because they don't move. They're just a clerestory on the exterior.
They're clerestories.
So if you've seen them, they're like little purplish square blocks. They turn purple over time
Because of the lead.
Is it lead?
Yeah. So what's confusing to me, and I've just done a little digging, it's unclear. All the articles I read said the windows were removed. So it's good. I'm glad they're restoring the original panes, but it was just really confusing me. I thought the windows were gone.
No, he put them in the basement. He didn't want to break all the glass. He just took them out. And that sort of gives lie to the whole claim that they're so rickety. If he was able to actually take them down and replace them with a big pane of glass without losing all of the individual panes, they probably just needed the $12,000 in work that he was complaining about. And that, of course, is the reason that when you get a tax break on your historic building by going through the Mills Act, which we assume has been the case on that property, we don't know for sure, you're supposed to then reinvest those savings into preserving this historic property that is an asset of the community. That's how it works, kids. Don't forget, or you'll get a nasty letter from the city, and you don't want that. I'm sure this is ending up costing more than it would have to fix them in place.
Kim, let's move on to some upcoming events. The end of September is almost upon us sooner than I can ever possibly imagine. The end of September, the 29th, Sunday, September 29th, our monthly Lava Sunday Salon. We've got Joan Renner talking about Aggie Underwood, who's my favorite Los Angeles newspaper city editor post-war. It's going to be a great talk. And your friend Paul is going to talk about bejeweled skeletons post-Reformation in Western and Eastern Europe.
Yeah, it's Paul Kudneris talking about his really extraordinary new book of photographs of things that really have not been seen in generations. These bejeweled skeletons are considered a little outre in the current Catholic faith, but man, they're interesting.
And immediately after the salon, that Sunday, the salon starts at noon. Immediately after the salon at 2:30, we've got number 3 of Broadway On My Mind, the walking tour we're giving at the end of every month for the next few months still, just to raise consciousness about Broadway in light of the funding going through for Strategy 1, Phase 1 of the Streetscape Master Plan for Broadway and all of our concerns around it. Just to name one concern, there's a lot of questions, a lot of concerns about the terrazzo on Broadway, and it doesn't look like an HCM, an historic cultural monument designation, is going to be possible. So it's just wringing of hands and asking how and why, and So this tour hopes to address concerns, identify shared goals amongst individuals and groups, and try and get some clarity on steps and outreach to keep in a feedback loop with the city.
Right, because everyone acknowledges that the Terrazzo is important, and if you look at the Bringing Back Broadway documentation, it's highlighted as important. But how is it going to be treated in any sort of streetscape change? Is it going to be surrounded by something new, contemporary, that basically forms a frame around it? You know, that might be a decision that's made, and I think that there are a lot of aesthetic issues raised by that.
Okay, we're not, can we can't, the Terrazzo question is so complicated. It's not a single decision by a public, by an entity within the city. It's not a single decision by a property owner. It's just it's very, very complicated.
Right.
And I don't even want to get ideas about what could happen or what not, because it's just it's a mess, and we encourage you to send us emails and ask us questions.
We also encourage you to go down and take pictures, as many as you can. Broadway is changing, and it's time to document.
Looking ahead, just in terms of lava stuff, November 10 is the Union Rescue Mission.
October.
Oh God, did I say November? Right.
You did, but I stopped you.
Thank you. September is almost done. October 10, Union Rescue Mission, Skid Row walking tour and screening. Okay, that's starts about 5. It's the walking tour. It's about 90 minutes. We've got a dinner on top of the roof at the Union Rescue Mission, and then right after dinner. They're having box lunches. I think it's $6 a pop. We have the screening, free screening of their 25-minute film of Scrap and Steel. And 1949 Main Street. It's an unbelievable document.
And reservations for these two free events, which are synced together, you can do one or both, will open up tomorrow on the Lava website. So reserve your spot. Not today, but tomorrow. That would be Tuesday.
October 20, that's a Sunday, Kim. That's a crime lab. We've got a crime lab coming up, and people need to act, because I think it's filling up. The title of the crime lab is Los Angeles, 1920 to 1947, Birth of Forensic Science.
Yes, and I've got about 15 seats left, so if you want to get in there quick.
Okay. It's going to be a really great event. Just some three or four landmark cases and their impact on the actual structure of law enforcement in Southern California and forensic investigation. So just Black Dolly is one of them, just as the single hook. At the end of October, we have the Charles Bukowski Literary Salon. And this is, of course, not a coincidence. We're interviewing Suzanne Lummis today. Suzanne Lummis, of course, in this interview, has some great anecdotes about Hank and his contribution to chapbooks. Poetry chapbooks in Los Angeles in the early 1970s through the 70s.
What a nice man he was. Really,
yeah.
People don't realize just how much he helped other poets and publishers. I love to hear Suzanne talk about him, because this is a side of Bukowski that you rarely hear about. You hear about all the gruff and bluster, but you don't really hear about just what a mensch he was.
Yeah, but we're going to stop talking about Suzanne for a second, because she is our first interview, which means I have to introduce our second interview with Pat first. So let me take a breath. I'm going to introduce Pat Adler Ingram. We're going to interview her. She's the second interview. She's executive director of the Southern California Historical Society. They are headquartered in Charles Fletcher Lummis's, Suzanne's grandfather's house, El Alisal, on Avenue 43. Just off of Griffin, and she's great. It's a great interview. The topic of the interview is simply El Alisal. So everything you wanted to know about that house. Okay, maybe not everything, but a lot. It's a great interview. I think it structures things and brings up themes that I have been sort of looking for myself for the last couple of years. So really, I think it covers all the major bases, and I'm happy to have getting it out there, and she is an utter charm and delight. Our first interview will be with Suzanne Lummis, Charles Fletcher Lummis's granddaughter, and we're going to talk to her about her grandfather, his house. We're going to talk to her about Charles Bukowski. We're going to talk to her about poets today and patrons of poetry today. We're going to tackle the question of, can Los Angeles sustain poets? How and why? And it's a front look, starting from her grandfather's patronage and work as a poet all the way up to the present day. And in the middle, we're going to get some great Charles Bukowski anecdotes. And we talk about chapbooks, poetry chapbooks in Los Angeles in the 1970s, which is one of my favorite topics, of which the Huntington Museum now has a really good collection of because they have Charles Bukowski's archive.
True. And you should go down and have a look. Maybe they'll let you.
One last thing I want to put on, one last thing we're not going to get into too much with Suzanne, but I want everyone to know about, because we're gonna do some work with her on this later, probably starting early next year. Poem Noir. Poem Noir, she was just interviewed last week on NPR about this. We'll include the link, and you can dig around in this, but just the whole notion of Old Bunker Hill inspiring poetry. And Bunker Hill, film noir, the location and the feel of film noir and the poetry it inspires, which is obviously really important topic for us. And we only touch on this lightly in this interview, but next year you're gonna hear a lot more about this.
Poem noir. It's the now sound. It's what's happening. It's what all the kids are into. More than IMAX.
So let's take it away with my interview with Suzanne. Pat, we're back with you at Charles Fletcher Lummis' house in Northeast Los Angeles. We're just off the Arroyo, and I would like you to introduce yourself and tell us where we are, and then let's just jump into the deep end. And I want to hear everything. I want to hear when he bought the land for this house and what it's all about.
Okay. Well, my name is Patricia Adler Ingram, and I'm the executive director of the Historical Society of Southern California, and it's an absolute pleasure to be doing this interview. And we're right here at the dining room table that Lummis used to gather his friends around. And if you were coming to dinner with Lummis, you might have found yourself across the table from John Muir, say, John Philip Sousa, just to make another John. There are altogether records of some 7,000 people who signed Lummis's guest book, who came here to this table, who had dinner, and then afterwards were asked to sing or recite or talk to the other guests. In other words, singing for your supper was the thing here. This house, well, Lummis bought this land, about 3 acres of it, and it's to this day undisturbed. He bought it in 1895, and his first idea was to plant eucalyptus trees in order to make his fortune, because eucalyptus was newly introduced, and the railroad ran just at our border fence here, where there still remain two huge eucalyptus trees that were planted by him in 1895, one of the first things he did on this land. Well, he continued planting eucalyptus, and then the next year he put some sort of a fence around the plot, and then he planted some fruit trees. And he wanted to have semi-tropical trees. He thought it was like the Mediterranean lands, so he planted accordingly, starting with fruit trees, with oranges, lemons, kumquats. We still have some that may be offshoots of the original kumquat trees. We've replaced the lemons and the oranges and so forth. And then 2 years later, he broke ground here. Well, in planting the eucalyptus trees, he knew immediately he did not have clay soil. He's not going to be able to do adobe if he builds anything, including a chicken house, which he did build. But he was going to need to use concrete. He saw that he had a good stock of granite boulders, which had been washed down from the San Gabriel Mountains. In fact, this land is the product of the face of the uplift that formed the San Gabriels. It's eroding at a geologically rapid rate, and it's continuing to do so, of course. The rocks are rolled down through Devil's Gate, where J.P. Hill is now, down the arroyo, and a lot of them lodged right here. Lummis did not think of dressing the stone. He thought of using the stone. So the first thing he did here was to level out a house site, and it was no small house site. It was to house his family and his guests and to be his castle for 1,000 years. One of the first things he did was to dig a basement. We have, of course, a small basement because he got tired, or it was his whim, not to dig a whole basement under this whole house. It was just enough to keep his vegetables, and it also was a place for his dark room. So he had a dark room down there the entire time that he lived here. From beginning, the first room that he built here was that great room. He called it El Museo. He liked to put Spanish names to things. He didn't mean museum. He meant a place to entertain the muses. He had a classical education. This just came to him that's what the room should be called. He patterned it after the great room in the Chavez house and a number of other houses in the Pueblos. He built the walls rock by rock, using concrete as the mortar. The walls are 2 to 3 feet thick. He was kind of a macho guy, although he was a small, wiry person, and of course he was in great shape. He was very strong, and he liked to show that he was very strong. So some of the rocks that he worked into the walls are of terrifically heavy and big volume. And he's got them like trophies worked into the walls above anybody's head. It was, he did start on the base with some humongous rock and then went from there to form the rest of the house wall. When he would decide he needed a window, he was working on the interior. So he decided where the windows were going to go by knowing where he wishes he could look out. One of the first things he built was an alcove in El Museo for a place for the musicians to sit. It's a half round, and it's the base of his tower, because he also had a kiva-like tower. Or in the case of some of his thoughts and writings, it was like a castle tower. He managed to do a beautiful design with these windows. At one point, he was making some of his doors, which to this day are a pleasure to open and shut because they do so perfectly. There is no dragging of the door on the door sill, and there is no gapping or anything like that. These doors are in perfect alignment, and this is 100 and some years later. Lummis worked on the house for about 12, 15 years. He never quit. He just quit. He didn't complete the house. There are still places where we can see he intended to put a balcony, a floor out on the second level at the front door side, because there are some doors up there that right now open on nothing. He was able to design a most beautiful window into which he set some of his glass plate negatives that he had collected on his trip with Bandelier to South America and the Pueblos. Otherwise, he built these doors, dovetailing them so that they're works of art, really. At one point, he wrote that any fool can write a book, and some of them do, but it takes a real man to dovetail a door.
he's correct.
Yeah. No, he believed in writing what he thought. And so that's what he thought at the time. The second floor of this house is where he had his study, which he called the Lion's Den. He had two roll-top desks up there. On one, he had the editor work for the Out West or Land of Sunshine magazines. On the other side, he was writing his own books. He wrote poetry. He did not do so easily. He worked on his poems and revamped them and rewrote them and then sent them out into the world, to the Cosmopolitan magazine, to Scribner's, to any place that he thought would give him a $50 check for it. He kept. I have the book where he, in his own handwriting, put the latest revision of the poem, and then details the date that he sent it to which publisher, and then when it came back, where he sent it the second time, the third time, a whole long list of his submittals till finally he'd get it sold. All of his writing was carefully revised. It sounds spontaneous. It sounds like firecrackers going off, but no, he was a very careful craftsman. He coined in the "See America First" phrase, and he was enough of a slogan writer to attract the attention of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad folks who were just beginning to realize that they could promote the Indian country with their trains that gave access for the first time to the Indian country. This ended up with Lummis getting a lifetime pass on the railroad, which he valued tremendously, with cooperating Southern Pacific pass as well. And it was just one of his most proud moments. One time in 1903, I'm sort of skipping around here, but in 1903, when Teddy Roosevelt came to the presidency, he came to visit here. He visited Occidental College, which was at that time right here in Highland Park. There's a beautiful photograph of Lummis walking with Teddy Roosevelt down the steps of the library of Occidental College. Lummis is talking, bending his ear. Anyway, as Teddy Roosevelt was getting ready to leave, they pulled a schoolboy prank, which was totally outrageous, but greatly gratifying to Roosevelt. Lummis, with his ties to the railroad, arranged with the train crew that Roosevelt could come into the cabin, take the throttle, and move the train out of the station while his social service men, the new guards that they put on the president, were still on the platform. This was a great prank. Roosevelt loved it. And also, Lummis had advised John Muir, when Roosevelt visited John Muir in Yosemite, that he should do something really spectacular for the president. John Muir set afire a chimney of an old, rarely rotted out sequoia. And Roosevelt danced around the fire like a kid. It was a great argument for the National Park Service, which Roosevelt was then espousing. Okay, to get back to the house here.
The Landmarks Club, maybe. Maybe right. this very table, the Landmarks Club was formed here.
You're right. If you came to dinner with Lummis, you had to be prepared, because for a while he was the one who had noticed the condition of the California missions. And he noticed it by taking brilliant photographs of the missions. And it showed the fact that livestock was being sheltered in the missions. The roofs were gone. And with an adobe structure, if the roof is gone, the structure is very soon down to a ridge of mud. He brought these photographs and showed them around this table here to the people that he invited to dinner. And they decided then and there to save the missions. Well, of course, they are going to need money. They are going to need a lot of money. So some people were able to contribute some money, but they got the idea of making a cookbook. And the main thing about this cookbook that makes it very, very valuable nowadays, and if you can find one on the internet, buy it, because it's got his whole portfolio of photographs of the mission. There are no food in there. That's in the text of the recipes, but the illustrations are the missions. The other society that he founded here was the one to pay attention and espouse the cause of the Native Americans, and that was called the Sequoia League. The people who signed up for the Sequoia League were, well, you might not say it quite so strongly, but I think they were kind of harassed by Lummis to contribute and to keep paying attention to the progress and greatly to the lack of progress with the realization that we are not treating the Indians, the Native Americans, fairly or in a way that will bring any good whatsoever to the nation.
Perfect. You did it. I want you to just tie a couple loose ends together for me, if you don't mind. Just one, actually. You mentioned this in our previous interview with you, and I want you just to really bring it home. At some point in Charles Fletcher Lummis's life, in the early 1890s, he has this sea change in his attitude towards indigenous peoples in North America and in Mexico, the Spanish-speaking peoples. And that's really his moment. And after that, everything comes into view. Before we leave you and we stop this two-part look at Lummis, could you just talk a little bit about that sea change and really where he was when it happened and really just before and just after?
Well, I believe that it was while he had paralysis and was actually living in the Pueblos that he began to think about it. But then when he was building this house, the ideas developed and he found that he was turning to that remembrance as he builds a fabric of this house. Now, there's one thing that I haven't mentioned at all, and in fact it doesn't get as much notice by us in history as it should, and that is his interest in the Spanish influence in the West, and particularly in California. At the time that he joined the Historical Society, which was shortly after he arrived in Los Angeles, we were just translating and publishing a volume of documents that Sutro, San Francisco Sutro Baths fame, had imported from Sevilla, from the Archivo in Sevilla. They've got tremendous archives there because they were keeping careful a track of what their forces were doing as they went into the New World and how they were getting along with first discovering the gold that they were sent for and then maybe silver. But anyway, this body of documents telling how they were going to govern this land and how they were going to parcel it out because all of this land belonged to the King of Spain. They were going to parcel it out to people who had contributed to the well-being of the Spanish crown in the new lands. They would give them land, but it was not fee simple title as the English method was. This was to use it and to benefit from the land, but it still belonged to the King of Spain. Well, Lummis was writing at this time and produced a book about the Spanish influence here that is, I understand, still known and in print in Spain. We have lost sight of it here, but because of his work with this archive and going well beyond it and showing how the local California mission system developed. He was awarded a knighthood by the King of Spain, and the knighthood was brought here to this house by the Duke of Alba. The Duke of Alba made a formal presentation out there in the museo. Lummis has got his photograph very proudly displayed out there wearing the medal of the knighthood of the King of Spain.
That's fantastic. You did it. You did it. You threw us a great little bone that we can all chew on now. I want to thank you. This has been a great talk. I just before we go, I want you to tell people what they can do if they want to come visit the house. They just quickly tell us the hours of operation of the house if people want to drop by.
Sure. Okay, the Historical Society of Southern California maintains open hours at the house here where you will... very, very welcome to come. That's between 12 o'clock and 4 o'clock on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, year-round. We have a dedicated curator here who will tell you the story and in much greater detail than I've told it here, and answer your questions about Lummis the man and the house that he built. And we are just very, very pleased to have you come. We'd appreciate it if you could join the Historical Society, of course, because then you would be supporting all of our publications and not just our mission here with the house. And we continue the publications now. Have all been put online with JSTOR so that the entire run of our archive from 1884 to the present day is available to you, and globally, actually, with all of our articles. We go back so far that we've got eyewitness accounts to when the victorious forces of the United States of America entered Los Angeles with a band playing. And,
Pat, God bless you. Thank you for letting us visit, and we'll be back again, because two interviews on Charles Fletcher Lummis is only scratching the surface.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure, really a pleasure.
My name is Ed Rosenthal, and I'm in the LA Athletic Club, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
Suzanne, we're here at the Los Angeles Athletic Club on 7th Street, downtown. I want you to introduce yourself, and I want you to start to answer the question, why should people care about reading poetry?
Ah, all right. So I am, and now what was I supposed to say first,
who you are?
Who I am. I am Suzanne Lummis. Ah, that's that big question. Suzanne Lummis, a poet, an organizer of poetry events, an advocate for poetry, although sometimes I wonder, every once in a while I have moments of self-doubt, is poetry really important? I have written plays, had them produced also. I do a little bit of literary criticism, have written some essays, and I am known for two or three schools of poetry. One of them is the Fresno School, because I studied with Peter Everwine, Chuck Hanzelcheck, and Philip Levine in the San Joaquin Valley in a group school that became rather important, interesting, and produced several important poets, and I'm associated with something called stand-up poetry, which is a literary poetry that also aspires to have the virtue of performance poetry in its energy, its humor, its irreverence, its sprightliness. And then finally, and most recently, I am associated with something called the poem noir, which takes its inspiration from film noir, those black and white crime movies of the 40s and 50s with names like Gun Crazy and Kiss Me Deadly. And from those movies, I learned something that I could apply to poetry. And I teach a class in that through the UCLA Extension Writers Program.
That's That's a fantastic introduction. You did great. I want you to try and explain to us why people should care about reading poetry, though.
Well, you know, there's two lines of thought on this. And one is that poetry and the engagement with language and the details of language that you get from poetry will really enrich your life and enrich your own engagement and understanding of language and how language can work. But there's an opposite school, a contrarian school of thought, which is also very appealing in the way that the devil is appealing as opposed to Gabriel. Sometimes I want to go to the dark side. And the dark side was especially well expressed by the New York poet Frank O'Hara, who said, you know what? People are always trying to get everybody to read more poetry like it's vegetables. Eat your asparagus. It's good for you. If they don't need poetry, fine. Bully for them. You know, and there's something sort of seductive and mischievous about it. Also, Mark Strand, who's a poet laureate back in, I think, 1990, and one of the premier poets of the country, once said, you know, I don't care if other people read poetry or not. I don't know those other people who don't read poetry. If they don't want it, fine, they can live their lives. I get great pleasure out of poetry. I get pleasure out of the poetry of Wallace Stevens. I am delighted by the poetry of Emily Dickinson. And then he mentioned several other people. And he said, all I care about is my own pleasure. I don't care about a bunch of strangers and what they're missing out on. And that also is very appealing. But I tend to take the other position, which is that if people can find poetry and find even a dozen poems that they take pleasure in, those poems will be with them forever. Sometimes the stocks can go down and you can lose some money. Sometimes what else is there? Your retirement fund can go down. But if there are some poems in your life that you love, you own those and nobody can take them away from you.
That's very good. That's a very good start. Let's narrow our focus. Let me ask you, is Los Angeles capable of producing and sustaining poets? This is a question Charles Bukowski sought to answer in 1972 in the introduction to his anthology, An Anthology of Los Angeles Poets. And so I'm going to ask you, is Los Angeles capable of sustaining poets? And if so, why? How have you done it?
Well, one way that it's capable of sustaining poets is if you can't get work here and you can't achieve any fame here, and you can't pay your rent and you end up getting evicted, you can at least get yourself a little tent and live down on the sidewalk on San Julian, and that sustains you. Whereas if you lived in Chicago, you couldn't do that. That's okay. So that's something on the positive side. Poets who live here take a heavy hit in terms of one big sacrifice that you make. And that is that Los Angeles does not have the means to help poets build their reputation and sustain a nationwide reputation the way Manhattan does. All the old, big, prestigious publishing houses still are on the East Coast, and some of them are in deep financial trouble, and they're struggling, even some of the oldest and most powerful. But still, there's a way that the East Coast in Manhattan is able to honor and acknowledge their poets. And Los Angeles is just a newer city. We don't have all that stuff. Maybe later I will talk about a new literary magazine that will be coming out of Santa Barbara soon that that may start to give poets the visibility that they have had a hard time getting. It's all about, there's two strands of poetry, and one is the spoken word poets, and they tend to not care so much about publication. It's all about performing in venues, and it's about the ephemeral, in-the-moment experience of hearing the poetry alive, and they have competitions, sometimes called poetry slams, that have to do with who is the liveliest and most impacting performer. And they inhabit a rather separate world. But for the poets who are interested in publishing, it's tough to be in L.A. It's a good community in terms of fabulous people. A lot of places to read. Not that many first-rate publications out here, though.
Let's hold that thought about publications for just a second, because we're going to get to that in a second. I want to put on the table, because we're going to wrap up with both of them at some point, looking back to Los Angeles poets. I've mentioned Charles Bukowski. I'm going to mention your grandfather, Charles Fletcher Lummis. Before we get into this really interesting event coming up at Beyond Baroque, the launch of this new magazine, I want you to look back. Start at the very end with your grandfather, or start in the middle with Bukowski and work backwards, but just give us a sense of the chapbook in Los Angeles from, say, 2000 to 1900 in either direction. And really, your grandfather was one of the first guys putting out chapbooks in 1900.
Well, when you said earlier when we talked about this, you were talking about his self-publishing. And when I think of Old Man Lummis, I call him Old Man Lummis. Only I get to call him. Well, you can also call him Old Man Lummis. You'll get a special dispensation to call him Old Man Lummis if you want to. When I think of Charles Lummis' self-publishing, what comes into my mind immediately was his brilliant enterprise, beautiful and such a work of art. He, when he was living out on the East Coast still, he took birch bark. He took birch bark. He began to realize that these thin sheets of birch bark can actually be peeled off and come off so thin and so durable. They're like rather fragile paper. And he had studied the printing technique, and he was in fact a printer. And so with this tiny, minuscule print, he was able to set these plates and print his own poems on these exquisitely miniature birch bark books. And then he found an illustrator to illustrate his poems, and they're about 2 inches high or even less. There are still several of them in existence. I owned one. And he sold these for 25 cents on the East Coast. And you know what he was able to do with the money that he made? You will enjoy hearing this. Put himself through Harvard. In those days, 25 cents was more, and college was cheaper, Harvard was cheaper, and 25 cents was more. And there's a certain number of these that still float about. Every once in a while, one comes up on eBay. So that was one of the most ingenious and artistic things that I think he ever did. And then when he came out here, what comes to my mind that was influential was that he began to edit The Land of Sunshine, which I think he changed the name to Out West. I always forget whether it first started as Out West and became Land of Sunshine or was Land of, I think it was first Land of Sunshine. He changed it to Out West is, I think, the order it happened in. And then I suppose he published some of his own poems, but what he did was recognize and publish some of the most gifted young writers in the area and some of the cowboy poets and some fine prose cowboy writers, essentially. And one of the most important people that he ever published was the very young, extraordinarily talented poet named Nora Mae French, who lived down here before she went up to Northern California and became part of the Carmel and San Francisco Bohemian poets. She had a magical talent. It's very too bad that she killed herself by cyanide, not an easy way to go, I don't think, just shortly before the emergence of the modern movement in poetry. Because you can tell from her work when you read it, she's right on the verge of discovering the modernist spirit in poetry. But it was before Ezra Pound came along and defined modern poetry and what it was. And she was writing a sort of a late Victorian poetry, but you could tell what comes through in her work that I do not hear in any of the other poetry of her day or her milieu is a strong sense of a deep personal voice, this melancholy voice that seemed to rise from her psyche, and this use of imagery that you didn't always see, and something sort of relaxed and natural in the language, which you didn't find in the other poets, even Ina Kulbrit, the first California, the first poet laureate of California, but Nora Mae French had something in the voice that sounded like the way people talk. A very real tragedy. So the lesson there is don't kill yourselves, anybody. You don't know. You might be right on the brink of some new thing that's going to happen.
That's very good advice. I want to jump ahead more than 100 years to now, and I want you to talk about Miramar. And the event at Beyond Baroque, and then we'll take a step back and we'll wrap up with Charles Bukowski and the Salon coming up, which you're going to participate in, and his involvement in chapbooks, and perhaps an anecdote or two from you about that. So let's start with Miramar, and we'll get ourselves triangulated.
Okay, so I am pleased and uncharacteristically hopeful, because I am the all-time skeptic pessimist of L.A., or at least Northeast L.A., but I'm really hopeful about a new magazine that will be emerging from Santa Barbara and will be seems to be very inclusive of the poets of Southern California and California, called Miramar. It is the project of Christopher Buckley, who was recently retired as a professor from UC Riverside. Miramar, the first issue, which will be coming out in the fall, includes nationally known poets, celebrated poets, recent poet laureates, Philip Levine, Edward Hirsch, Charles Simic, Naomi Shihab Nye, all of these poets who are among the best known poets across the country, with some of the most interesting Los Angeles poets. And that's something new that has not happened. There's been magazines before, many magazines. Good little one down in Orange County called Spillway, which is a lovely little magazine. But no magazine has really drawn together some of the most interesting voices of Southern California with widely recognized names from across the country. And I think this might help put Los Angeles, oh, I guess the old overused expression is on the map, as a place where, as you say, what did you ask me earlier? Can we survive here? Can we live? Can we endure? Maybe it will put Los Angeles on the map as a place where gifted, interesting poets can survive and sustain themselves.
That was fantastic. And now there's a launch party for Miramar at Beyond Baroque. Let me set this up and you can fill in the blanks. Beyond Baroque is in Venice. The launch party will be Saturday, November 2nd, and I'll let you fill in everything now.
Oh, that's right. There's going to be a publication party for Miramar, the debut issue of Miramar, Saturday, November 2nd at Beyond Baroque Literary Arts Center, which I think is 681 Venice Boulevard. Look it up to be sure, but it is west of Lincoln on Venice. And hard to miss. It used to be the old City Hall, the old Venice City Hall. It's big.
Good. So we'll put the link up for that on the webpage for this interview. People will go to that. We're talking about publications of poets. We're talking about Miramar. Let's go back about 30, 40 years. Let's talk about chapbooks and Charles Bukowski and putting out the call for poems for new chapbooks. We're now talking about mimeograph machines now. We're not talking about sending something to the printer and getting it bound, and we're not talking about blogging, and we're not talking about downloadable PDFs.
on subscription. We're going to talk about mimeograph machines. It's 1970, and there's a mimeograph machine. I want you to tell us Charles Bukowski's contribution to Los Angeles poetry chapbooks.
Okay, well, Charles Bukowski, and if anybody's heard of maybe two or three or four poets, Charles Bukowski is probably going to be one of the poets you've heard of. Quite a beloved poet in Los Angeles who lived on the edge, and in fact below the edge, beyond the edge, whose much of his poetry involves drinking and wild nights with women. And I think he has a poem called Lack of Almost Everything, which absolutely expresses his situation, living and quite desperately, actually. He touched the hearts. Oh, he would not like that expression, touch the hearts. It's so corny. It slipped out. I can't help it. L.A. poets were extremely fond of him because even when he became very, very famous, if they were starting a new little magazine, and back in those days, people, the magazines looked terrible. They were stapled. You know, they just looked like heck. I don't know if I can say crap, but anyway, I can say that. Oh, that's good to hear because it came out of my mouth. And you wrote to Bukowski, who by now, late in his life, was becoming actually famous across, at least across a quarter of the world, hugely beloved and popular, and had cult followings around different places in Europe. And you wrote Bukowski and asked him for a poem, and right away he would send off a packet of poems to you, and he always had a little squiggle that he did, a little sort of image of his face, and he would sign it Buck, you know, here, yours, Buck. What poet can you do that with? You can't. I mean, if I wrote the current poet laureate and said, I think I've got a new magazine, do you think she is going to send no, you know, disrespect intended toward Natasha Trethewey, the current U.S. Poet Laureate, but she's not even going to get the envelope or open it, and she's not going to send it off to some new little magazine. And the way that he retained his great feeling of connection and affection and affiliation with the grassroots poets of Los Angeles made him completely different from everybody else.
You did it. Fantastic. So we've really demarcated an interesting problem space here. We're gonna get back to that in a second. I want to, before we start to wrap this up, mention you're gonna do a literary salon with us on Charles Bukowski on October 26th. So just the weekend before the Beyond Baroque event for Miramar, and so we're very excited about that. You're gonna be there. We're gonna have several speakers. Tom Hyrie from UCLA Special Collections is gonna read some letters from John Fonte to Charles Bukowski. It's gonna be good stuff. So we're really excited about working with you on that. I want to thank you, and I want to just, before we go, I want you to really take another breath, and after all we've just said, try and answer the question, looking back to your grandfather, to the current day. I'm going to ask you, who's helped poets the most exist in Los Angeles? I know every poet by existing in Los Angeles helps, but really, if you can just sort of point us in some directions we can look at to answer that question, how poets can exist in Los Angeles.
Ah, well, you know, every single generation down from the emergence of Los Angeles as an independent city, every generation has had its heroes and its champions. In his day, Charles Lummis had a very good eye for recognizing talent. And as soon as he recognized talent, he absolutely had to champion them and to publish them or do whatever he could to help them in their endeavor. Recently, I mean, certainly among the current generation, I would say Bill Moore is one of the great champions of poetry and one of the historians of poetry who is recording this current generation and the past couple of generations of poets describing their endeavors, their achievements. He wrote a book called Holdouts, The Poetry of Los Angeles, from, I think it was something like 1950. 1950 to 1992 or something like that. It has those dates. So it's Bill M-O-H-R, and he's somebody who immediately comes to mind, is so important. Beyond Baroque and all the people who've been the directors of Beyond Baroque Literary Arts Center are all champions. The current director is Richard Modiano, and this is one of the very few places in the West, anywhere in the West, an art center that was founded for and by poets. Other places, they just allow poets in every once in a while to be benevolent. But this is a place that is really for and by poets.
That was fantastic. You did it. You nailed it.
Oh, good.
You knocked it out of the park. We're gonna have you back. We're gonna do this salon with you. We've got Lummis Day to look forward to next year, 2014, the first Sunday of June.
Every June, first Sunday of June.
We have a lot to look forward to. Maybe even one day we'll do a podcast about my favorite Los Angeles poet, Thomas McGrath.
Absolutely. He's one of the most interesting Los Angeles poets who is so under-recognized. I would be jazzed to participate in anything you do with Thomas McGrath.
He's kind of my hero.
He's a very interesting man. He stood up to the House Un-American Activities, you know? That's right. He took a stand. You know what he said? He said, I have to be loyal to my tribe, and by my tribe he met the poets of the world. He had to be loyal to them and not the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Well, I think we figured out our next podcast. We're going to go to where his house was, just off the 5 freeway, and we'll read some of his poems and talk about him.
Okay, I hope you invite me back then.
Suzanne, thank you so much. We'll have you back.
I'm coming.
My name is Craig Berry. I'm in Venice, California, and you're listening to You Can't Eat the Sunshine.
And we're done. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our podcast for the week of September 23rd, 2013. Our two guests this week were Suzanne Lummis. She is a poet, and she is the granddaughter of Charles Fletcher Lummis, which was, to a large degree, the topic of this episode, this week's podcast. We also interviewed Pat Adler Ingram. She's executive director of the Southern California Historical Society, and an author of a really interesting book about Old Bunker Hill that she wrote in the late 1960s through Siesta Press. So you might want to do some digging on that. That's a good book. And she also wrote a history of the city of Venice, California, for the city of Los Angeles in the 1970s.
Late 60s or early 70s, which we recently acquired, and it's just got the most wonderful graphic design. And I want to go and visit her again and show her this book and get it signed and hear a little bit about this project.
And just spend quality time with Pat, because she's a dear. So those were our interview, the people we interviewed this week, and I want to thank you for listening. I want to encourage you to continue to stay tuned, and in addition to all that and the goodwill that alone brings, we want to hear from you. So if people want to reach out to us, Kim, how do they do that?
Oh, it's so easy. It's easy as sending an email to youcanteatthesunshine@gmail.com or just going through the contact link at www.esoteric.com. You can also come up to us at a lava event or at an esoteric tour and let us know how you're enjoying the podcast. We love to hear from you. Also, if you're so inclined and you're a user of Apple products, iTunes carries the podcast, and you can go to the page where You Can't Eat the Sunshine, and you can give it a star rating. Please give us all the stars if you like it. You can also say a few things. And if you're someone who listens to other podcasts, it's nice because recommendations happen based on similar things people are listening to. So it helps to get the word out, and we so appreciate it.
Okay, good job. Good. Okay, Kim, we're in the home stretch. We're just going to call out some upcoming bus tours. We're going to call out the next six upcoming bus tours. The first three are crime bus tours, so I'm going to take a breath and sit back and let you get us through the first three.
True enough, September 28th, it's Pasadena Confidential, a tour of the dark side of the Rose City. We do not have Crimbo the Clown joining us this time, so if you're scared of clowns and have been avoiding that tour because it is our only crime bus tour with a crime clown aboard, now's the time. I can't promise this will ever happen again. However, we can promise you all of the thrills, chills, and excitement, and runaway chimps and insane rocket scientists that we always have on this tour. It's one of my favorites. Then coming up on October the 12th is Blood and Dumplings, a crime bus tour of the San Gabriel Valley, sort of on the northern side, and just the most deranged individuals settled in that part of the world, and we'll be hearing some of their stories and all the trouble they got into. The Man from Mars Bandit is the character I want to highlight today in thinking about Blood and Dumplings. This is a man who manifested himself as a space creature and held up supermarkets. And he completely terrorized the San Gabriel Valley before dying in a hail of, well, actually a single bullet from a marksman. And is just one of the weirdest people you could ever hope to encounter and will forever change the way you think of a particular intersection in the SGV. Also coming up is our most popular crime bus tour on October 19th, The Real Black Dahlia. Of course, it's filling up. It always does. So if you're thinking of getting on that bus, I'd recommend you buy your tickets soon. It is a walk in the footsteps of Elizabeth Short, the victim in the most notorious unsolved murder case in L.A. history. And we really try to understand who she was, what she was all about, and how she got into the situation she got into. It's a what most people say when they get off this bus is that it's a very compassionate look, and that's what we seek to do, to provide some compassion and some understanding of a just fascinating, tragic figure.
No closure, though.
There is no closure in any murder, whether it's solved or not.
Okay, we're gonna look ahead to the end of October and the beginning of November. Saturday, October 26th. Raymond Chandler. I have my Raymond Chandler bus tour. And that evening is the Charles Bukowski Lava Literary Salon. So just park at the club. Get on the bus. Park at the athletic club. And it's like $13 to park the whole day. And then you'll go on the bus tour. You'll get off. You'll have a martini at the bar.
Have two martinis at the bar.
And you'll unwind for an hour or two. And then the salon will get started. And it'll just be great. And at the salon, we have a liquor sponsor for the salon, so that'll be good. So get on that bus on the 26th and just come for the salon and just make it an esoteric day. I think Boris the chef will make sure you have a nice snack in between your bus tour and salon. I will personally make sure of that if people who come on the bus tour go to the salon.
In fact, we'll even tell you where they keep the popcorn.
Exactly. Saturday, November 2, it's my Jamie Cain tour, The Birth of Noir. This is a great tour. This is very much a tour that complements the Raymond Chandler tour. Cain, Chandler, Double Indemnity, film noir, these are all topics we deal with on both the Chandler tour and Cain tour, though it is on the Cain tour that we really roll up our sleeves and I think do the most heavy lifting in terms of Double Indemnity and its impact as the thing that started film noir. So that's Saturday, November 2, and we end at the King Eddie Saloon for a drink on Skid Row, which is something Jamie Cain did a lot at that intersection, 5th and Los Angeles. And that's so we'll stop there. We can only look as our headlights don't go much farther than that.
No. In the far distance of November, I see your 45th birthday bus.
Yes.
And I want people to know. No, I know, but I know. But I want people to get on that bus because we're going to spend about 8 hours exploring together. And we're going to the Antelope Valley. And there'll be cake. And you know you want to come. So put it on your calendar and get a ticket for Richard's birthday bus. It's less than regular bus adventures, even though it's twice as long because it's a party. Come out and play with us.
So I want to thank you again for listening. I want you to stay tuned, and I want to remind you,
you can't eat the sunshine.
You can't eat the sunshine, but you can make a beeline for the best of the coastline. La 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 la. Skid Row, Solano Canyon, the Doria, and Pico Union, the long-lost neighborhood called Hermina between South Pass and Highland High.